please stay tuned to the end of this program or see the show notes for important information regarding today's speakers and the content of this podcast. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Allergy Talk, a roundup of the latest in the field of allergy and immunology by the American College of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology. For today's episode, we'll be reviewing three articles from the latest episode of Allergy Watch, a bi-monthly publication which provides research summaries to college members from the major journals in allergy and immunology. And you can also earn CME credit by listening to this podcast. For information about CME credit or to read archived issues of Allergy Watch, head over to college.acaai.org/publications/allergywatch. And also, we do have the Doc Matter community. That's where you can discuss these articles. So we'll try to make a post and we can discuss this on the website. Hello, everyone. My name is Jerry Lee. I'm an associate professor at Emory University, an assistant editor of Allergy Watch, and I'm once again joined by the editor-in-chief of Allergy Watch, Dr. Stan Feinman.
Hello, everybody. Yes, thanks, Jerry. It's great to be here. And I'm also in private practice in Atlanta Allergy and an adjunct faculty member at Emory.
And we're really excited to have another assistant editor from Allergy Watch join us, Dr. Samantha Knox. Sam, why don't you tell the audience about yourself?
Hi, everyone. Thanks for having me. I'm a pediatric allergist at Gunderson Health System in La Crosse, Wisconsin, and I also serve as a clinical adjunct assistant professor for the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health.
Well, thank you again for joining us and, again, all of us for contributing to Allergy Watch. So, Stan, let's start with you. We're always really concerned about access. You know, we always seem like there's enough allergists, but it sounds like there's significant consequences to this.
So this is an article from the Annals that was published in December of 22, and it's entitled Race and Ethnicity Define Disparate Clinical Outcomes in Clinical Rhinosinusitis, and that the lead author was Consor, and she's from Rush University in Chicago. And the interesting thing that they did here was they did a prospective cohort study, which included 977 patients who were diagnosed with chronic rhinosinusitis, and they were receiving care in their urban tertiary care center over the five-year period from 2015 to 2020. And what they did then is they classified the patients based on their race or ethnicity as either white, that was about 63% of the patients, as African-American, and that was 24.1% of the patients, or as Latinx, which is 13% of the patients. And these patients were self-identified. So that's another thing that I think that's important because we've talked about that on our podcast previously about the influence of self-identified race. But anyway, the interesting thing is if you look at the clinical findings at baseline, were pretty similar. They really were. And then they looked at the results of the outcomes after 40 months of continuous management, so almost a four-year follow-up. And then they adjusted for various demographic variables and comorbid conditions and things like that. But the baseline chronic rhinosinusitis severity was similar among the groups. They also did the CT scoring, and the Lund-McKay score was also similar, but a little lower in the whites, 8.69, a little higher in African Americans, 9.36, and also a little, in fact, the lowest was in the Latinx, was 7.82. They also did the sinonasal outcome test, that's the SNOT 22 score, and those were pretty similar, a little higher in the Latinx patients at 36.9, lowest in the African American at 31, and was 33 in the white patients. So, compared to the white patients, the African Americans had fewer chronic rhinosinusitis visits over that follow-up period, the 40 months, and they were less likely to have an allergist evaluation. They had fewer allergist visits. They received fewer antibiotics for their exacerbations of the chronic rhinosinusitis during their follow-up period, and that was in the African American group. The Latinx patients had fewer allergist visits and lower antibiotic use, and the mean SNOT 22 was significantly lower in the African Americans, 26.9, compared to the 21.6 in the white and the 22.3 in the Latinx patients. So, despite the similar baseline characteristics, the African American patients who had chronic rhinosinusitis received less frequent follow up. They had worse clinical outcomes compared to the white patients. And the authors discussed the likely contributors to these disparities, including barriers to healthcare access, lack of allergist evaluation, and a lower rate of proper treatment of the exacerbations. And this was in Chicago. Now, Vivian Hernandez-Triolo, who did the comments on this, stated that she felt that this represents an opportunity for the practicing allergist to aid in the education of referring physicians. And in fact, the college has had an effort in this to try to help understand these racial disparities. This was presented in a proceeding of a roundtable discussion that Luz Financier, when she was past president, and Mark Corbett, when he was past president, published in the Annals just a few years ago. So the college has made it a real goal for college members to be more aware of these health disparities. But I thought it was interesting. It's a prospective study, and it does demonstrate that the patients aren't getting to allergists.
I think that it's a very interesting study, and I agree we need to look at more resources about these disparities and really start to target some of that because we want to have that full access to care. I think if we can look at what are those barriers, you know, who is getting referred to an allergist, so going back to primary care as more of that, and education also back towards our primary care providers on when do they need to see an allergist too, and getting them in, even with those same symptoms at baseline. How much were the referrals out? How frequent were referrals out? Because a lot of times seeking out somebody comes from the recommendation from somebody else, you know, seeking out a specialist comes from another recommendation. So a little bit more education on that and follow up with that may be also helpful. But I think we have a lot of work to do within this realm.
Yeah, I'm really glad that you mentioned both the college's role in this, because at least I've been fortunate to participate in a bunch of different many episodes in this podcast series called Moving Toward Equity. And, you know, that's part of the Vision Forward strategic plan the college has been doing, trying to expand educational content related to racial disparities. The lead author, the senior author in this study, Dr. Montevinia, actually did really nice breakdown on chronic rhinosinusitis with or without nasal polyps in underserved population. So I would absolutely catch that episode if you want to get more information about why this is happening. And we actually had a patient interview as well. But, you know, listening to her story, it was just so interesting. And it's everything you can imagine. It's access, it's lack of recognition when you seek help, and it's the environment that you live in that contributes to lack of control. So, like, there's multiple things that as we do our educational campaigns, all aspects of the problem have to be addressed, from environmental exposures, access, and also recognition and prompt referrals. So I think that sort of ties it together. Please check out that podcast if that interests you. I think Dr. Montevinia was just a really incredible speaker. Sam, you also have a very interesting article. Bring awareness is something we don't think about in our eczema patients.
Yeah. So this is an article out of the Journal of Allergy and Clinical Immunology stating it's called Atopic Dermatitis and Risk of Autoimmune Conditions Population-Based Cohort Study. It's a really interesting cohort study because we know that atopic dermatitis affects, you know, 20% of children, up to 7 to 10% of adults. We think a lot about this in our practice because it is such an atopic condition. So we have a lot of thinking about the other things like allergic rhinitis, asthma, food allergy. But we don't often think about autoimmunity related to it, though there have been prior studies that have associated it. And we think about when we think about allergic conditions and atopic dermatitis, we think about IL-4, IL-13, IgE. But there have been studies looking at the kind of the chronic relapsing atopic dermatitis that have more of a Th1, Th17, Th22 patterns that kind of go into that same pathway also seen in autoimmune disease. So prior studies have looked at this, but the interesting thing about this cohort study is that they looked at the co-occurrence of the most common autoimmune conditions and to evaluate whether the risk of autoimmune disease is related to the atopic dermatitis severity. So they actually looked at a really large primary care database out of the United Kingdom from 2009 to 2018, looking at those newly diagnosed with atopic dermatitis within the year and their severity assessed into kind of the mild, moderate, severe cases. And I'm going to comment on what they thought was mild, moderate, or severe, because they're kind of looking back at charts and characterizing it secondarily, not as the diagnosing physician. So mild was the default, but then moderate was those prescribed a potent topical corticosteroid or a topical calcineurin inhibitor within a year, and severe was considered those using systemic immunosuppression or having been referred to a specialist. And they matched kind of 4-to-1 with controls for every atopic dermatitis patient and looked at autoimmune diseases, things like inflammatory bowel disease, celiac disease, rheumatoid arthritis, pernicious anemia, hypothyroidism, quite a number of them, lupus, Sjogren's disease, vitiligo, alopecia, and multiple sclerosis. So they actually had almost 174,000 atopic dermatitis cases matched to just under 700,000 controls. And they did show that the atopic dermatitis cases had a higher prevalence of autoimmune conditions than the controls. It was about 5.84% versus 4.31%, and a higher incidence of new onset autoimmune condition over 4.1 years in the patients with atopic dermatitis. So like the hazard ratio being about 1.28, so maybe about a 30% increase. Atopic dermatitis was also associated with an increased prevalence of a number of different autoimmune conditions, Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, hypothyroidism, rheumatoid arthritis, psoriatic arthritis, Sjogren's, vitiligo, and alopecia areata. And the interesting thing when they looked at the severity, comparing mild, moderate, and severe, there was actually, they found the risk for autoimmune condition doubled with severe atopic dermatitis. In children, though, the greatest risk was with severe atopic dermatitis, and really the only associated autoimmune conditions were vitiligo and alopecia, rather than the long list within the adults. So I think this is a really interesting discussion because we're always thinking about other atopic conditions. We don't really look at that autoimmunity, but there may be some things that you start kind of linking together with GI disease, respiratory disease, dermatologic disease. We know that the skin presents, it's our largest immune organ and likes to present with a number of different things that can also mimic atopic dermatitis. So one of the limitations within this study would be that these were diagnosis codes. So that initial diagnosis of atopic dermatitis, was that correct or not? So they're taking into account that they're assuming that that diagnosis was correct, but there are a lot of things that can manifest looking like atopic dermatitis, but were actually something else too. We know in adults, new onset atopic dermatitis kind of red flags us to say, hey, let's relook at this. Let's look at their prior history when they were a child. How atopic are they? Have they ever had eczema before? And what other kind of symptoms do we see? Are there systemic things going on? Do we need to get dermatology involved with this? Have they been involved in, you know, is a biopsy needed? But it's really something I think that we need to pay attention to, because as allergists and knowing access to care in general, we see a lot of skin conditions. So being aware of some of these things, how to truly diagnose atopic dermatitis, and when we think like, hey, there might be something else going on here. And also, we're going to see these kids and adults, you know, as continuity patients in longevity. We have a specialty that we see them from children into adults, and watching for some of those other things, understanding that there may be a higher risk for them would be really helpful to be able to catch that and then enlist their primary care and other specialists to help us out with some of those other diagnoses.
So, you know, this is interesting, but Sam, I was curious, you know, I sort of think of atopic dermatitis as a Th2 mediated type disease, and some of these autoimmune conditions aren't. They're more of a Th1. Mm-hmm. So maybe there's more overlap than we know about with atopic dermatitis. Maybe that's what this is showing.
Yeah, I think you're correct. They've mentioned in prior studies that with those acute flares, we see a lot more of that Th2 type pattern. But with some of the more recent studies looking at kind of the chronic atopic dermatitis, you can see some of those Th1 patterns. So I think we have to take into account, you know, how acute it is, the other systemic symptoms, the response to typical atopic dermatitis therapies as well.
I agree, Stan. I think this was very provocative when I read this, because you're right. I just think of the typical atopic diseases associated with AD and not the autoimmune diseases. Though I really liked your point about adult versus pediatric. I think when we see an adult with AD, you know, it's not as common. There is something potentially different, especially if it's adult onset, because I know the children had less autoimmune disease than the adults in this group. So there's something different about adults who either have childhood onset that persists to adulthood or have new onset. Their immune system is probably different a little bit. And I think that should warn us to maybe dig a little bit deeper in those adult patients. I think I'd like to go to the next article that was reviewed by Brad Chips. And the title of the article is Low-Dose Oral Corticosteroids in Asthma Associates with Increased Morbidity and Mortality. This is in the European Respiratory Journal, and this was a Denmark study. So what they did here, the study was done in Denmark. So essentially what they did was that they have obviously a national health system that can evaluate the entire population. They can get data on the entire 5.8 million inhabitants. And they were able to look at asthmatics who received oral corticosteroids and those who it did not. Now, they tried to focus on younger ones, 18 to 45, because they want to rule out COPD. And certainly, they tried to rule out cystic fibrosis and other diseases associated with corticosteroid use, connective tissue diseases and IBD, malignancy, adrenal insufficiency, and so on. But I think the real question is, if you get an oral corticosteroid prescription as an asthmatic, is it really as benign as we think it is? Because I think they get a lot of oral corticosteroids, or at least people don't think about giving dexamethasone or prednisone beyond that one-time dose. But cumulative, if we follow patients over time, and again, they have like 20 years of data here, what is the actual long-term consequences of these individual decisions we're doing over time? And so, you know, they have this registry, they can get full data, ICD codes on this population, and they were able to get a pretty large amount of data. So they were able to get 287,000 patients, and they have 30,000 who received oral corticosteroids and 121,000 who did not. And they kind of risk stratified them versus their lifetime cumulative dose. So low dose was like 500 milligram prednisone equivalent. Then they have like this medium 500 to 2,000, and 2,000 or above would be considered high dose. And again, we don't really know exactly how they were given, but essentially what they found was even if you were in the lowest category, we're talking about like 500 milligrams or less, like during the study period, you had an increase of potential comorbidity in all the outcomes that they looked at. I mean, they looked at osteoporosis, fractures, diabetes, adrenal insufficiency, heart disease, depression. And when you compare non-users and users of oral corticosteroid, they looked at this relative difference between the incidence rates. And the highest ones, and again, we're talking all comers here, I'm not just talking about low dose, were for depression, anxiety, which was 4.3 incident rate difference, fracture, 3.0, diabetes type 2, 2.3, and then as well as things we would imagine, heart failure, cataracts, and so on. So it was interesting, especially the low dose. I think the low dose, the fact that you get signal, even with getting just no more than 500 milligrams, which you can imagine would be like a couple steroid bursts, to have a detectable increase in morbidity. And again, there was a slight signal in mortality, although asthma-related death was actually rare in the cohort. It should bring us to attention that there is actually some long-term consequences in, even though we don't appreciate it at the time. Now, the editorial for this article did note that they also had medication data on this population, and 15% of the oral corticosteroid user cohort were not on inhaled steroid, and 55.7 were on low-dose ICS. So that was very interesting. You have like, gosh, like at least like 70% of the population not on, you know, step three or step four therapy, and they're getting oral corticosteroids. So we have to kind of unpack that too. Like, that's quite remarkable. And so I think that just, again, makes us really carefully examine that each exacerbation is probably a clinically significant event and drives us to educate our peers not to think of just giving oral corticosteroids during exacerbation as a benign intervention, that potentially this is something that requires more aggressive intervention.
You know, Jerry, it's interesting. When I saw this, I said, well, I don't really use very high dose. 500 milligrams, that seems like a lot. You know, my typical course of prednisone is almost 250 milligrams. You know, it's a 6-day course for exacerbations, and some of the patients might need it several times a year. So I can get up to that 500 milligram pretty quick. You know, so it's interesting that they're bringing this up. And the fact is, you know, maybe we need to be more aware of some of the steroid sparing strategies that are now on the forefront for asthma. And in fact, I'm going to be talking about immunotherapy as another benefit for asthma in one of our podcasts coming up. But it's interesting that even our normal rescue prednisone, you know, course is pretty high.
Yeah, this is quite eye-opening because I agree with you. Just one single course is kind of half of that. When you think about the guidelines and kind of allowing maybe one per year and not changing any therapies, they hit two per year and you're kind of saying, okay, but then we hit the 500. In typical courses, we hit that 500 at that two per year. We really should be looking at the guidelines and doing step-up therapy and being aggressive about managing that and reducing that. Especially I see a predominantly pediatric population. Sometimes by the time they've come to me, they've been in the ER urgent care several times and have five or six courses of prednisolone or dexamethasone, something like that. So really getting them in and access and making sure we have good primary care and then asthma allergy access too, to get in and really kind of stop that cycle of getting it and educating them and trying to get them controlled with all the other therapies. That's quite shocking.
You know, what is very interesting, and it actually convinces me even more, is that the data that comes out of the Sigma trial that shows that intermittent inhaled steroids prevents exacerbations now becomes even more imperative, that really GINA's recommendation to universally recommend intermittent ICS combined with bronchodilator makes a lot of sense. It does prevent exacerbations. I think albuterol alone more and more seems to be not the strategy here, especially considering that reducing steroid burn potentially could have a significant effects on long-term comorbidities. So I think it's something for us to at least reconsider, that implementing that intermittent ICS treatment strategy. What are you waiting for? I think that's really the question. So anyways, this was a really great discussion. Thanks to you for listening. If you did enjoy what we talked about, please rate our podcast on iTunes. It really helps a lot. And obviously, if you have any feedback for us, if you have a suggestion for us to talk about, any corrections that we'd like to make, or any feedback, please send it to our email address. It's allergytalk1word@acaai.org. Please remember, if you'd like to see me credit for this episode, go to our website, college.acaai.org/publications/allergywatch. We also have archived issues that you can read about all the articles we talked about today. And I hope you enjoy the rest of your day. Thank you for listening. ACAAI is presenting this podcast for educational purposes only. It is not medical advice, nor is it intended to replace the judgment of a licensed physician. The college is not responsible for any claims related to the procedures, professionals, products, or methods discussed in the podcast, and it does not approve or endorse any products, professionals, services, or methods that might be referenced. Today's speakers have the following disclosures. Doctors Lee and Knox have nothing to disclose, and Dr. Feynman has been a speaker for Takeda and has done research for AIMmune, DBV, and BioCryst.